We have something to learn from the 70s. I think this could be the foundational one from which the others flow, which is to expand the level of our aspirations. You know, that to be able to think and recognize the possibility of liberation in its various forms. Feminist liberation, gay liberation, black liberation, workers' liberation, all the liberations that were talked about in the 70s, I think are perfectly a framework in which we could learn to think. Sometimes it seems like the reaction on, let's say, the established left is to say, we just need a defensive action. Or being satisfied with small steps. I would say that this is exactly the moment we need to think big. In fact, these crises demand it. I think we have to think in terms of liberation. It's the only reasonable course of action.
Hey guys, hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Dissents Podcast. I'm your host, Lukas Ondrejka. I'm very glad you're here because we have another great episode in English. On the program this week, Michael Hart. I guess for most of you, Michael doesn't need an introduction. Many of you will know him from his works with Tony Negri, who just recently passed, as we know, the Empire Trilogy, for example, but also their most recent book, Assembly. Michael just wrote a book on his own, flying solo after so many years in collaboration with Tony. It's called The Subversive 70s, and in it he covers the political movements of the 70s and what lessons they hold in store for the political struggles of today. Yeah, and what can I say? As a longtime reader of Michael, I'm really super, super happy to have him here. Michael, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, let's talk about The Subversive 70s. Your book, right. I found it a truly informative and inspiring account of some of the liberation movements of the 70s. You go back and visit struggles in the United States to Latin America, Europe to Africa, as well as Asia, ranging from workers' rebellions to feminist and anti-racist movements and many, many more.
Yeah.
It's, of course, not an historical account. How could it be? But rather, it takes a look at what made those struggles subversive and emancipatory and what lessons they hold for our political struggles today. Mm-hmm. We want to talk about all of that in more depth. But for starters, what motivated you to actually return to the 70s of all decades? And why do you think it's worthwhile for our listeners to take a close look at the subversive of those time? Because many, like me, are too young to have even experienced the 70s firsthand. We know it only by historical accounts. So how can they still speak to us today?
Well, I too, in a way, I mean, I was alive during the 1970s, but I was not politically conscious in a way. So there are some teenagers who were politically active and I wasn't. So for me, it too was a return. I mean, a return in a for the first time, you know, experiencing them. You know, I would say one claim I make is that the 1970s are relevant for us because the 70s are really the beginning of our era. In part, what I mean by that is whereas the 1960s and, of course, the movement, 1960s were extremely important and transformative. They were essentially marked the end of a previous era, and the 70s marked the beginning of our own. And that's why, you know, it's partly that claim that they are relevant for us. Mm. You could approach this one, you know, from the other side, if you will, which I think is easier for people to understand, which is that in the 70s were developed many of the characteristics of the forms of domination that we face today. Think of studies of neoliberalism starting in the 1970s, economic shifts between post-Fordism, between Fordism and post-Fordism, the outsourcing of industrial production from the dominant to the subordinate parts of the world, and a variety of other ways of studying it. My focus is really on the other side, you know, about the way the movements were organized and about their aspirations. And I guess the thing to prove, if one is going to prove that the 70s are the beginning of our era, would be for me that the political problems that they individuate, you know, that they recognize and that they face and they worked against are still our problems. Mm. And so in a way, that's one thing I'm trying to track throughout the book is the way that, you know, when I say, and like you said before, that they have something to teach us. What they have to teach us in part is what the primary political problems are. And they were in a way a first experience, a first essay of how to face them. I guess that all of that is the reason why for me returning to revolutionary movements of the 70s seems, you know, not only interesting intellectually, but politically relevant. Hmm.
You already talked a bit about the 60s, and you do that as well in the beginning of your book, in contrast to the 70s, because I think that's true for the United States as well as here in Germany. I don't know for other parts of the world, but when it comes to looking back at those times of upheavals, and you state that in your book as well, the 60s are kind of regarded as the good decade, whereas the 70s is the decade where everything went kind of nuts or went to shit.
Yeah.
It went to shit for the left. And so many people say that it was fractious times, it was violent times, and also unsuccessful times.
Yeah.
So one might ask the question, why return back to the 70s and not the 60s? And you already said that the 70s are much more relevant because this was the beginning of many of the problems we face today. But again, maybe you can talk a bit about these paradigms that you also tackle in your book that say that first the 70s were not of importance in contrast to the 60s because nothing of importance happened there. And the other paradigm is that everything for the left went wrong in that decade. Maybe you can elaborate a bit on those paradigms and what you think about them.
Yeah. I mean, it's a complicated and many-sided question. I think that in part, you know, one argument should be that the image of the good 60s, you know, which often means up until 1968, you know, of course, like you said, these are different in different national contexts, but this notion of the good 60s as nonviolent, strictly peaceful, is really not true. You know, like there's an image. So in this regard, and maybe many others, there's a kind of false image of what the 60s were. And so that's one of the issues to face. But there's other ways in which I think exactly what the standard disparagement of the 70s revolutionary movements with respect to the 60s are, in fact, in my view, great developments and opportunities rather than detrimental. You know, so for instance, this notion about the 70s being an era of fracture on the left. I think exactly that, what's really being referred to most often are the contestations of other liberation movements to the previous assumption of the ability of industrial workers' movements to lead revolution as a whole. Hmm. I mean, I think that this, of course, not universal, and it's even in each national context, there's a certain amount of contestation, but there's quite widespread assumption, I would say, still in the 1960s, that the industrial workers' movement is the primary protagonist. You know, of course, you know, there was within the workers' movement itself, too, and within socialist and communist parties, they would pose the woman question, as it was called in English, or the race question, you know, but it was always in a way subordinated to that expectation that the industrial workers and their movement could be the center of gravity, let's put it, at least that of the revolutionary movement. So this fracturing was a kind of contestation by feminists, by activists of color and others, and that created a kind of fracturing, but I would say a necessary and beneficial fracturing, if that's what it is. I would rather use the term multiplicity for this rather than fracturing. Fracturing assumes that a unity is the only model of coherence. And so the term multiplicity for me at least shifts that terrain and recognizes that a coherence can be achieved through a articulation of relatively autonomous struggles. So that's one. I mean, then I probably shouldn't go on with all of them because it takes too long. I mean, the question about violence is also an important one. Maybe I should just say about that is one shouldn't discount the violence of the repression during these years. And in many ways, you know, even decisions of groups for armed struggle that I would, you know, contest, or I think that they're mistaken in their reasoning. At least one has to recognize the context of extremely violent repression against different activist movements from the police, in some cases from military forces, but also through all kinds of other, let's say, judicial legal mechanisms, counter-information, the whole list goes on. So that if one thinks about, if one's going to pose the question of violence, one at least has to start from the context of an extreme repression that then activists had to discover ways to react to. And I think some activists, but we should leave this part here, I suppose. I think some activists did discover what seems to me the most beneficial way of dealing with the question of violence and how to face repression, much better than the groups that get the standard attention, the clandestine armed struggle groups, which I think, you know, I understand their reasoning, or I could give an explanation of what their reasoning is, but I think they were fundamentally mistaken about the benefit of conducting that form of armed struggle against the repressive state. Mm.
Yeah, we want to, of course, talk about those movements that you cover in your book, and that should get much more attention in contrast to small militarized group like here in Germany, the Red Army faction, and elsewhere. There were also many groups that were clandestine and did armed struggle and carried out terrorist attacks. But while we're still on that topic, maybe that can also teach us something about the mistakes of the past.
Yeah.
Which can also be insightful for our struggles today, because I subscribe to the idea of multiplicity, and we can talk about this topic later, because still I think it paralyzes the left that there are like kind of this nostalgic idea of the working class, and you see that with projects here in Germany. I don't know if you heard about Sarah Wagenknecht and the rupture in the left, and
right.
There's kind of this nostalgic anti-feminist, anti-migration, authoritarian notion of what left-wing politics today are, and this is like kind of so paralyzing for the left as a whole. But yeah, when it comes to multiplicity, there's also, one could say, the problem of maybe, and that was maybe also a thing of the 70s, sectarianism, and also maybe vanguardism when it comes to these small clandestine groups that thought they were like the spearhead of revolution and could lead like the working class. And in Germany, when it comes to sectarianism, there were all those small K groups, they were called, yeah, kommunistische Gruppen. In the end, they were like maybe two people or so, and they didn't have like a mass basis.
Right.
So what in your eyes were troubling mistakes that we can also learn from? Because I think it's too easy to say this is something that has nothing to do with us, because it's part of what the left is.
Yeah.
So even though it gets too much attention in media and stuff, right now we had arrests in Germany of one former RAF member. So it gets too much wrong attention, but still it's a part of our history and we should tackle it in some kind of way.
Right. Absolutely. I totally agree. But and like you say, I mean, this is, I don't know if this is a useless preface, that one of my stumbling blocks in starting this project, and one of the things that I thought most strongly, was that precisely these groups, the clandestine armed struggle groups, have an outsized role in our imagination of the 70s, both on the side of those in power and also on the left. And so one of the things that I was trying to do in the book is to recover what seemed to be the more interesting groups that get eclipsed by this attention of the spectacular actions of these clandestine armed struggle groups, which were, of course, a very, like you're saying, a very minority position, and I think not adequately representative of the most interesting things on the left. That said, I think what you're also right that we have to confront it. There are many different ways I'd approach it, but let me just start with two. The first, which is not really answering your question, it's more of a, you know, something I came to realize about the different clandestine armed struggle groups, putting them together. And of course, there are differences, like there, because I'm thinking of, for instance, the Weather Underground in the United States. A group that I didn't know and learned a lot about and became fascinated by, called the East Asian Anti-Japan Front in Japan, which in some ways, like the Tupamaros in Uruguay, at least in their early period, and the Weather Underground, were dedicated towards a kind of symbolic bombing of sites as a public pedagogy. You know, this is what I guess I would say unites all of them together with the Red Army faction in Germany and Japan, the Red Brigades in Italy, is they're really motivated by an indignation at the impunity of the state in its criminal activity. And they wanted to, thought that they could, do a kind of public pedagogy, very national oriented, you know, a serve as a national conscience about the Nazi past that remains today, for instance, in Germany, or in Italy too, and in Japan too, of course, maybe the US too, about its imperialist role, about racialism. So there's, I guess what I wanted to start with was just a recognition that these were not idiots. They were not completely misguided. They were driven by something that I think is, you know, fundamentally right, you know, which is that each of these nations has not only a horrible burden in its past, but that that continues in the present and that the population is not conscious of it. And they thought that they could do, like with the Weather Underground doing these symbolic bombings, that they could teach the public about this. I think they were mistaken in that, but at least I wanted to recognize they had a thing. Mm-hmm. I think what's fundamentally, I don't know, mistaken or misguided about all of these groups together, and which, because this one, coming back to what you said about what they can teach us today, was that they were almost by necessity separated from the movements, like separated from the kind of political exchange that one gets in kind of collaboration in a more movement terrain. And they became, you know, however much they thought that they could, you know, sometimes they thought that they could be a kind of spearhead, like you said, or something like that. They were really detached from and didn't benefit from. See, this is the other thing that one should recognize is how much we all benefit from the kind of exchanges that happen in movement organizing. I don't know, male activists do become feminists, or at least, you know, moderately, or you know, people are trained in anti-racist questions when they participate in movements. And so that kind of separation, and maybe this is the part that would extend to you, to the sectarian groups that you were talking about, the kind of separation from the terrain of movement debate is what seems to me really one of the most detrimental aspects. So my criticism of these clandestine armed struggle movements, that they were detached from the movements, I mean, they could easily respond, well, we didn't want to be, but we had to be, you know, we had to be clandestine because we would. And I think that's true. And one has to figure a way if the way any kind of organizing doesn't, you know, allows the kind of circulation and debate and education, yeah, that one gets from the movements. So anyway, the discussion of multiplicity might move back in that same direction. Like you were saying, in some ways, the way you were characterizing sectarian groups of the 70s is a refusal to participate in a multiplicity, you know, to mark a kind of separation. I worry that what I'm saying, someone's going to listen to it and say, well, that's a very small condemnation. I have no principled condemnation of the use of violence. I mean, I do think they were wrong in what they did, especially the ones who were aiming at, you know, violence against persons rather than violence against property. But that doesn't seem to me the central debate, violence versus nonviolence. It's really about the productivity of movement organizing and movement reasoning, collective reasoning, something like that.
Yeah, no, I get it. I agree with you there. And I found it right that you put that towards the end of the book to not take away from the attention that you want to put on like the other important groups that lead by example or important for us today. So maybe let's talk about them, about some of the groups that you discuss in your book. And it's really a wide variety, one has to say, ranging from industrial workers movement, feminist movement, national liberation, anti-imperialist struggles, anti-racist movement,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. And as I said, spanning many parts of the world. So maybe you can elaborate a bit. How did you come up with your personal selection? And if people read it, they might say, okay, why did he not take this movement into account?
Yeah.
But how did you come up with your selection of struggles and movements? And as I said, at first glance, they can really seem very different and to have very little in common.
Right.
So despite all the disparate collections and the cultural differences, what do they actually share?
You know, I welcome that response, and I expect that response from someone reading the book. You know, why don't you talk about this movement? Why don't you talk about that movement? It's the kind of thing a book like this asks for. And of course, like you're saying too, my own limitations, you know, not only limitations of space, you know, making the book twice as long wouldn't be a great idea, but also my own limitations of what I can understand, my own linguistic limitations and such things. But I do think, yeah, maybe there's a double argument that I guess I need to present. One is that it's not like there's a division of labor by whereby activists act and intellectuals think. that activists in movements do a great deal of theoretical production collectively. It's often in a different register than, you know, the kind of work that intellectuals do in libraries, but I think it's equally valuable. And so that part of what I took as a hypothesis or axiom or assumption is that these movements produce concepts. And so part of my job then, I thought, was to individuate and understand the concepts that these movements are producing and working with. And it's at that level then that I can recognize a shared conceptual matrix, I guess, among these movements. It's not always a shared vocabulary. Sometimes different terms are used. But for instance, you know, we've already talked a bit about this concept of multiplicity, which seems to be extremely important. Autonomy is another concept that I think is moving in the different, in these different movements. A rethinking of democracy, I think, is extremely prevalent. And then maybe better than all of them, or which maybe encompasses them all, is this notion of liberation, which was seemed to me omnipresent in the 70s. And it's something that I feel has fallen into disuse for more modest goals today.
If you kind of speak of liberation today, people kind of look at you if they have no political vocabulary or knowledge and kind of think you're nuts.
Exactly. I mean, how could you dare to think that? We need to think in smaller terms, have a smaller horizon of transformations. So it seems to me that that's something, you know, one of the things that when you were saying at the very beginning, I, you know, that we have something to learn from the 70s, I think this could be the a foundational one from which the others flow, which is to expand our the level of our aspirations, you know, that to be able to think and recognize the possibility of liberation in its various forms, feminist liberation, gay liberation, black liberation, workers' liberation, all the liberations that were talked about in the 70s, I think are perfectly, are kind of things that a framework in which we could learn to think. So anyway, to go back to your other point is I think maybe two things are accomplished, or I try to accomplish thinking on this conceptual level. One is to recognize some shared characteristics among this wide variety of movements. You know, what does the gay liberation movement in the 70s have to do with the feminist movement and have to do with the workers' movement, et cetera? You know, that these then also, like you're saying, the disparate national contexts, you know, sometimes this is created by a circulation of struggles, you know, either, you know, reading the news of what happened in Chile with Allende's, you know, coming to power or his overthrow could have, you know, have direct effects on elsewhere because the news traveled. But also, you know, activists traveled in this, you know, in the 70s, you know, I don't know, black workers in Detroit went and did speaking tours in Italy at the factories and things. So, I mean, so there's not, shouldn't be that much of a surprise that there's some sort of continuity among revolutionary movements in that sense. And all of this gives some rationale for talking about the period as a coherent unit. I mean, any periodization around decades has got to be a little bit messy. It's not like on January 1st, 1970, something started and it ended at 79. I would guess, you know, in many national contexts and in some ways what I'm talking about is what started in 68 rather than what ended in 68. And then it's, you might think of it as, you know, I don't know if Reagan Thatcher, you know, in Italy, sometimes they date it a certain end with the 1980, a mass firings at the Fiat plant in Turin. I mean, there are many ways one could think about this. It doesn't, that isn't what so much what matters to me. It matters like a certain coherence of, yeah, like I said, a revolutionary conceptual matrix. I was going to say vocabulary, but that it's not always the same terms, but it, a certain conceptual matrix that I think is shared. And that's what I'm, in some ways, what I'm trying to emphasize.
You already mentioned what you hear in this podcast called a revolutionary matrix, like the concepts that these movements back then, in one way or the other, kind of developed, and which I think can also prove useful for us today. So first, autonomy, secondly, multiplicity, then thirdly, maybe rethinking democracy, or one could say radical democracy, and fourth, liberation. Could you explain a bit more in detail, Michael, what these principles mean And maybe you can give a concrete example for each to illustrate the point, like a movement and how they use this term to organize themselves. Yeah.
I mean, that's a good question. It's challenging to be brief about that. But let me start with multiplicity. In some ways, for me, the concept of multiplicity requires the operation of articulation. And in fact, there's a further criterion that I work through in some of the U.S. feminist writings and activism at the times, which was that articulation. Yeah. So let me take the three together, really. So if there is to be a multiplicity, say a coherent form of struggling together of diverse movements of liberation, let's say that's what multiplicity is going to be. There has to be a process in which the movements themselves would not be unified, but would be able to recognize and maybe form, you know, lasting correspondences, you know, modes of struggling together. And this is what I'm calling, and I'm taking from certain groups at the time, notion of articulation. But so that then there's one more condition for articulation to be possible. And this is what I'm taking from US feminist groups at the time. There has to be no priority given either to different structures of domination or correspondingly to different struggles of liberation. For instance, this was so theorizing of the concept of capitalist patriarchy at the time. The notion was there can't be a concept of capitalist patriarchy if one assumes that capital is primary and patriarchy is in some ways a function of it or secondary, or even the opposite, you know, that there's a priority to patriarchy. Instead, one has to understand them. You know, they use terms like on equal footing or give equal weight. I would prefer to say it in the negative sense, you know, that they're not, there's no priority of one or the other, which then means that there has to be, for there to be articulation between a feminist movement and an anti-capitalist or a communist movement, there has to be no priority given among them. So anyway, you can see this is, that would be the same thing I would say about anti-racist movements, about queer movements, that there has to be, for there to be an articulation among them, they have to be understood as, yeah, not having a priority among them. And that therefore, in that sense, articulation is possible, meaning the construction of a shared struggle among relatively autonomous movements. And that's the construction of a multiplicity, you know, that's what that would be. You know, then one can have various examples of that. Yeah, here's one example that somewhat shifts the train, but I would say it's the same principle. I had become fascinated with a variety of movements in the 1970s that pose a multiracial movement, even a multiracial notion of democracy. And they do that by, and it's a key for them, I would say, is by refusing that there be priority of one racialization over others. You know, so for instance, this is the clearest case, I suppose, in these, in 1967 in San Francisco at a university, there was a student movement to protest, to demand both more students of color and to have courses, you know, about Black studies and Latinx studies, et cetera. And it was a successful movement. But what interests me is the organizing. They called the group the Third World Liberation Front, which is interesting in itself because they were all USers, but in some ways the notion of third world allowed them to see a commonality among them. So there were, in San Francisco State, this specific thing I'm talking about, there were five student groups, the Black student group, the Mexican student union, there was also a separate Latin American student union, a Chinese student union, and a Filipino student union. And what, so this is the example I'm trying to pose here, is that in order for a multiplicity to be constructed, it's not like you could say, well, the Black student union is leading us and they're the most important one. They're the one suffered the most. So somehow they gain priority. No, they had to create. Yeah. I don't know if a metaphor is right as a level terrain, but something like that. And for them specifically, this interestingly, and this functioned other times in the US in the 1970s, the notion of third world functioned for them as that terrain on which they could see themselves all as equal. See, I spent too long to just say multiplicity now. Let me try to do democracy super fast, and then we can see if it's better to move on to other things. One of the things that I was fascinated with the anti-colonial movements in the Portuguese colonies of Africa in the 1970s, you know, Guinea-Bissau, Mozambique, Angola, was the way that a notion of revolutionary democracy circulated as their aspirations. You know, so there were two terms that went together, popular power and revolutionary democracy. Mm-hmm. And in particular, many of the things I get, you know, there's some other of the leaders who wrote, not many of the other activists wrote, but the leaders wrote, but Amilcar Cabral in Guinea-Bissau was the one whose work we have most that's most useful. And so, you know, in one way he's posing, it's very clear when they say democracy, and Cabral is quite clear about this, of course, that it's not like they're trying to somehow catch up and reproduce a European liberal democracy of its institutions. In fact, one of the things they say is that we have a great opportunity because we don't have all of that, what you would call it, extra baggage that most colonizers actually leave behind. You know, so, you know, in some ways, they have an anomalous case because Portugal was the longest lasting fascist government. And in contrast to France and Britain in their colonies, they really didn't leave European democratic institutions. You know, so what I like, the phrase that really struck me is when they say that the Portuguese left no furniture laying about, you know, with this sort of metaphor of someone who abandons a house and leaves furniture that you then have to use. And they say there was no furniture. In some ways, we have the opportunity of creating it anew. Mm. The way, for instance, India didn't, or other French colonies that had already established a governmental and legal system that is then adopted in the post-colony. They were saying, no, we can create democracy anew. And that seems to me, using the term democracy, despite the way it's been corrupted in our general discourse, and not being afraid of the term because of what it's taught to children in Europe and the US, the idea that we can take that term and get it to mean something new. That seems to me common in a variety of movements, but this, you know, starting from Guinea-Bissau seemed like a useful way of trying to rethink democracy, starting from the ground up, something like that. Hmm. So those were two attempts. I'm sorry I went on so long, but I knew it would happen that way.
Well, no, that also gives our listeners a kind of a small glimpse into your book, and I encourage everybody to buy it. Maybe you can talk, Michael, briefly also about the idea of autonomy, because this is also a concept that sprung up in the 70s, which is also relevant for us today, I guess. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, there was a political and conceptual transformation in Italy throughout the decade that interested me very much, that moved from the notion of workers' autonomy, which in the beginning of the decade meant mostly the autonomy of workers, not only from capital, but also from the dominant trade unions, you know, that workers themselves could organize, struggle, go on strike, decide, etc. But that with a more or less a pivot in the middle of the decade when, as we were saying at the very beginning, you know, the way they posed it in Italy at the time was that the centrality of the industrial worker was destroyed. You know, like the central protagonism of the industrial worker was destroyed in Italy in the middle of the 70s, like in many other places. And what's interesting to me is that the concept of autonomy shifted in Italy to mean not just workers' autonomy, but also the autonomy of feminist movements, of the gay liberation movement, of different sectors of the workers' movement, etc. And they developed with this notion of autonomy the aspiration. I mean, things developed only partially, in part because of the repression in Italy at the time, but the aspiration of a kind of network form of organizing, which again refers to the notion of multiplicity, I suppose, that each of these liberation moments is relative to autonomous itself from the others, you know, but that they are able to struggle together. I mean, that's one side of this notion of autonomy, I guess I would say, you know, that feeds into the notion of multiplicity. There's another side of it, and maybe the more relevant one, which functions in many movements of the time, which is that autonomy, meaning that our political struggles don't have to be primarily aimed at asking for concessions from the state, that instead we can construct alternatives ourselves. Mm. Yeah, here's a super minor example, but one that's close to things that I'm working on now, actually, but is that before abortion was legalized in the U.S., there was a collective in Chicago Now, there's an excellent documentary film about them. They were called the Janes, you know, because they wanted to remain anonymous, but they gave their phone number out and said, call this for Jane. And they created a circuit of providing abortion for women who needed abortions. And what it did is it created, you know, I'm sure others, and it's important work to petition the Congress and petition the courts and make abortion legal. But they said, well, we autonomously can make abortion, provide abortion, even when it's not legal. And so that kind of, I mean, that's a super small example of this question of autonomy, but maybe a bigger example and also well known just because of the US's position that the Black Panther Party did similar sorts of things, providing free breakfast programs, free clinics, et cetera. They were not saying, look, the state needs to give free breakfast programs for our community. They were saying, no, we can do it, taking this autonomous action. Mm. So, I mean, maybe there are a variety of different ways in which this notion of autonomy can function, but those are at least some that should give people an idea of what. And this is, I would say, really prominent in a wide variety of movements today, this notion of autonomy. Mm.
That would just be my next question. Where do you see today when you look at the political landscape, maybe in the United States, but maybe also elsewhere? Where do you see like inspiring movements that take to heart the learnings from the 70s
right.
and push forward like a liberation style politics? In Germany, I don't know if you heard about the kind of neo-socialist initiative Deutsche Wohnen und Co. Enteignen. It's for the socialization of housing in the capital of Germany, in Berlin.
Right.
And of course, it's not framed in these terms, but they kind of push forward an autonomous politics because via a referendum, they tried to compel the state to buy back housing that was in the neoliberal era sold to big companies and that is now running up the rents in the city.
Yeah.
It's also multitudinous or articulates multiplicity because it thinks also in terms of feminism to provide housing for single moms, for example. It thinks in the term of anti-racist politics. And it's also, of course, anti-capitalist, yeah, but also really democratic or radical inhibition when it comes to democracy, because they plan not to nationalize the housing, but to actually socialize it in the sense that they form councils where different interests manage the housing of the city in the future. Mm-hmm. This kind of seems to me the perfect example for such an aspirational politics today. Mm-hmm. So maybe I wonder where you see today like inspiring projects.
That's a super great example. And it does remind me in some ways of these neighborhood commissions that existed in Portugal during the revolutionary period, where they too, at a neighborhood level, were deciding about how to distribute housing, how to house the people who didn't have housing, and making even decisions about providing childcare, et cetera, but doing it at neighborhood councils, which seems like an interesting correspondence with what you're saying. Mm. The two, let me give two examples at the opposite ends of the spectrum. And I don't think that these explicitly have references to taking up some things from the 70s, but I see resonances with them. You know, to just come back to the abortion question, now that abortion is becoming illegal again in the United States, in some ways we're returning to the early 1970s. And in the area where I live, we're forming collectives to provide abortion access without any recourse to either the clinics or to the state. I mean, as you know, this is something very different from the early 1970s. Now with medical abortion, you know, taking pills, it's like super safe and super easy, doesn't really require doctor's care and stuff like that. And so setting up collectives, you know, I think it's also important, like it was in 1970, to, I mean, I think clinics should all provide free abortion possibilities. The state should reform, the laws should be passed. But in the meantime, one can also organize it autonomously. That's all that I was saying. It's like I say, very small example, but nonetheless, I think that's the instinct of many activists. Which is not a substitute for demanding that the government changes policies, but at least a supplement to that. At the other end of the spectrum, and I would say this part is more aspirational than giving concrete examples, but I think that today in the US, the discourse about abolition is the closest thing that I see of that aspiration to liberation. Mm-hmm. So abolition functions in a wide variety of discourses now. It, in some ways, the recent origin of the discourse about abolition is around prisons and the police. But then it's queer theorists talk about the abolition of the gender binary. Feminists are talking increasingly about the abolition of the family. Migrant scholars and activists talked about the abolition of borders. I mean, that this notion of abolition, I think, travels quite a lot. And, and if the project of abolition were complemented by a process of constitution, then it seems to me it could function as a liberation framework. You know, at least the notion of abolition has the radicality, by which I mean going to the root of the problem, that liberation does. On its own, it's possible that abolition could, you know, simply be a focus on destruction rather than on the process of constitution, which would allow it to function in liberation discourse. But it does seem to me that it has the radical potential or the height of the aspiration that projects of liberation have. That's where I see a kind of commonality.
Mike, I want to briefly touch on the notion of multiplicity with regard to like left-wing politics today, because for me, there still, and I mentioned that in the beginning, seems to be like this parallelization, because there is at the core maybe a disregard for the multiplicity of labor and an expanded concept of the working class, sort of that the insight that the new left formed in the 70s is still disregarded in many ways. Of course, your Empire trilogy with Tony kind of grapples with the idea of expanded idea of the working class and how to find ways to organize in this changing landscape.
Right.
So do you see that as well, that this is still today paralyzing us? Or where do you see like problems on the left?
I mean, I see both. I mean, I see both. What should I call it? A mandate towards multiplicity in many of the movements, even labor movements today. And I also recognize what you're talking about as the, I mean, you were saying, and I think I would see it the same way, a kind of tenacious nostalgia. But let me start with the former. I mean, the former is the easier part. And at least I recognize it, and I'm talking just now about, in some ways, you know, my own observations in every strike that, you know, even in a small scale that I, you know, have experience with, say, you know, the baristas at the Starbucks go on strike, or the Amazon warehouse workers go on strike, or even Google workers, you know, organize. And each of them, there's a mandate or an aspiration to multiplicity. You know, the Starbucks baristas, you know, they'll say something about the conditions at the Starbucks and about their pay, but they'll also they'll talk about Gaza, but they'll also talk about racism and queer politics and feminist need. You know, they have an aspiration that their struggle is not just about them or even just about labor separated from these other issues. So I think that, but you know, it's also true of the United Auto Workers. I mean, that I would say at the different levels of labor organizing, one can recognize this aspiration to multiplicity. Like I say, I'm posing it as aspiration because I don't think it's awfully difficult to realize, to make concrete. But I do recognize, even though I recognize that on the one hand, I recognize what you're saying too, which is a, you know, in the U.S., I recognize it, but I think it's the exact same thing you were talking about with division in the Linke. In the U.S., the term would be that there's a persistence of a class first mentality. And there are two levels of it. And you were suggesting this a few minutes ago. One is a view of what is the working class that is often, if not reduced to, at least represented by industrial labor. And so the first thing one has to do, I think, is recognize the multiplicity of what the working class is and the multiplicity of the different forms of labor, different forms, you know, some of them precarious forms of labor, some of them might count on what service work, different variety of different things that really, in order to understand what the working class is today, we need to do a kind of investigation of class composition, you know, see what work is really like. And then also maybe a second level of multiplicity is about the relation between class struggle. And I hope I'm not sounding like I'm not in favor of class struggle, by all means, you know, like that's certainly, I don't mean to, but the relationship between class struggle and other liberation struggles, you know, that, you know, I guess I'm operating under the assumption that class struggle cannot adequately subsume or represent other liberation struggles. I think what I'm saying is rather simple and easy to understand. You know, you said something right at the very beginning, which struck me about, I think if I heard you right, remember it right, a certain nostalgia that's involved in this. And one of the things that struck me is that the nostalgia is in part, I think this is the way you were intending it, for the days when the industrial working class was strong, when the unions were strong, something like that. I think that this is also a nostalgia, maybe at a slightly different level of thinking about it, a nostalgia for when politics was seemed simple. You know, like you're on this side or you're on that side. You know, you're with us or you're against us. And that it was very clear what the lines of struggle were and what the nature of the enemy was. And whereas, and this is something that's definitely true about the 1970s that I think is something we are in the midst of today, which is that it is super complicated. You know, like there isn't just a one side and another side. There are what we have to think is the many forces in struggle and even the multiple structures of domination. You know, so it would be, that's why I feel like a certain nostalgia for the factory, a certain nostalgia for a revolutionary movement in which the factory was the center of gravity, that it is really a nostalgia for a clean politics. And what we have today is a messy politics. And I feel like we need to be in the messiness. I mean, we need to recognize migrant struggles and labor struggles, which don't always necessarily coincide. And we have to be able to engage both of them. And feminist struggles and queer struggles and anti-racist struggles, which in some ways, it's just a taller task, you know, a more difficult task that we have to face. And that it's in that sense that I'm interpreting this nostalgia that you and I both are talking about as partly a wishing that the lines of our political thinking and organization were more simple. But I think it's important that we recognize that they're not and we deal with the messiness.
Yeah, for sure. This brings us back to the question of articulation that you also pose in your book. And I think there are these examples like the socialization initiative in Berlin that successfully articulates like a common idea for the future that's inclusive for many struggles.
Right.
Just as an outlook, Michael, you talked about the spirit of liberation in the 70s and that it would be good if we would expand our aspirations as well. Our political aspirations, granted that the political circumstances are quite different. I mean, I was raised in the post-political era and the left got defeated after the financial crisis. And there's, of course, this famous saying, Mark Fisher popularized it, right? That we can imagine today more the end of the world than the end to capitalism. And kind of this maybe also started in the 70s. And you described the 70s as the history of our present. When in 1977, the Sex Pistols published No Future, and kind of many kids by that point ran around with No Future shirts. So the future was closed by capitalism with the starting neoliberal regimes then and with the neoliberal triumph in 89. But I feel that right now, due to the many crises we live through, the climate crisis, the political crisis, the crisis of liberalism, that there is like this politicization and there is an idea for the future is coming back.
Right.
So maybe you can, just for the end, talk a bit about what we can learn in this respect from the subversives of the 70s. And of course, this brings the danger of romanticizing or emulating like the politics then while the circumstances have changed. So what can we take from the spirit of liberation back then? And how do you think we should relate to the subversives of the 70s, like today?
Yeah, let me start with that last bit, which is certainly a minor part of what you're asking, which is how we should regard the 1970s and our relationship to them. I mean, these revolutionary movements I'm talking about. A close friend of mine read the manuscript of this book before I was done, and he's someone older than I who was, you know, politically active in the 70s. And his response was, you know, Michael, this is all very inspiring and everything, but we lost. We lost all of these movements. Everyone lost. And so what I've thought about this, and I think I make a distinction between failure and defeat. Like for me, failure is when a movement is characterized by an internal flaw, and its downfall is in a way due to that flaw. Whereas defeat, for me, is due to the overarching power of an external force. Mm-hmm. And so I would say rather than failures, the movements that I'm talking about were defeated. And so the future of movements diverge depending on these two qualifications. You know, that it seems to me if a movement failed in the way I'm saying it from an internal flaw, well, you know, we can, you know, praise it or criticize it, whatever we want, but essentially that was a dead end. You know, that was the end of the road. Whereas something was defeated, it seems to me it lives on. You know, it lives on because and poses a kind of, what should we call it, a stepping stone from which we can begin again. So that's the way I, you know, tend to regard these movements. Yeah, not as something to reproduce. Obviously, we can't do that. Like you said, the situation is different, et cetera. But rather to, in some ways, see their achievements. And, you know, their achievements in part can be just recognizing the nature of the power and the political problems we're faced with, but take those achievements as a beginning point. Mm. So regarding our aspirations and even the discourse of liberation in the 1970s, you know, maybe I could just pose it. This is, I know, inadequate, but at least a starting point that today we are facing such enormous both crises and forces of repression. Think of the climate crisis itself, but also the growth of fascist movements and all kinds of other threats. Sometimes it seems like the reaction on, let's say, the established left is to say, we just need a defensive action. Like, let's preserve the status of the Constitution. A defensive action or being satisfied with small steps. I would say that this is exactly the moment we would need to think big. Mm. In fact, that these crises demand it. Small steps are not going to address the climate crisis. Small reforms, small barriers are not going to stop the march of these fascist movements. I think we have to think in terms of liberation. It's the only reasonable course of action. Your question implies a much larger discussion. So it could seem like I'm saying something that requires that requires more substantiation. But at least maybe those listening could take it as a challenge, you know, that my position that the only reasonable thing today, the only effective way today is to act in a much more radical framework and aim for a much more radical social transformation, that this is really the pragmatic solution. Mm.
Yeah, Michael, thank you so much. One last little afterthought. Many of our listeners, me as well, know you from I already mentioned it, from your works with Tony Negri, the Empire Trilogy, for example, or Assembly. I just wondered, since he passed so recently, did you have another book with him in the making? and what's for you, who was so close to him, worked so many years with him, what's for you his legacy in your eyes?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can answer the last part. But to start, the practical part, the first thing, you know, there isn't a book really, but we, you know, when Tony was ill, you know, in the last period, he said, you know, Michael, we only do books, but maybe we should think now in a series of articles. And if I live long enough, we'll finish it and we can put them together in a book. So there's some at least outlines of, you know, more or less completed essays that I'll try to finish. It's a little strange to do them without him, but that's the thing. I mean, that's the other thing, which isn't really answering your major question, but it's the more personal one, which is that this book on the 1970s, the first book I've written alone in 30 years. And I don't know how other people do it. It's lonely writing alone. I'm so used to writing with Tony. We have, you know, we had a, for 30, 35 years, we had a, you know, every week we had a phone conversation about the book we were working on. So it's sort of, anyway, it seems that's just a personal thing. You are asking about a more, you know, more general question about Tony's legacy. And
I mean, he was one of the guys who was so, he was the radical in Italy, the face of subversion in Italy, not only intellectually, but also like in praxis.
In praxis, yes, absolutely. Yeah. So it's true that this, you know, the book about the 70s, even though I wrote it alone, you're saying it also has something to do with Tony, which is certainly true, but Tony has his hands in a lot of things. You know, if I wrote a book about Spinoza, it would also have Tony somehow present, or if I wrote a book about Marx or something like that. So,
yeah, sure.
I mean, what's interesting to me, and partly this is the kind of thing that comes out of these commemorations, you know, there have been a series of commemorations starting with the funeral in Paris and then other ones that, I guess it's easier for me, rather than answering that question, hearing other people answer that question. You know, like what? A lot of people are recounting, like, what was the first book they read, or how they first came to meet Tony, or how they, what kind of effect, you know, personal engagement with him had, or these sorts of things. For me, it's a little bit, I guess maybe I'm just not yet in the position to answer that question. I mean, maybe I'll have to wait a little more time pass before I can see clearly enough to do, to answer something like that.
Sure, sure. But yeah, as you said, many people owe him something. I mean, as I said, I owe him big parts of my politicization, and you as well, with your trilogy. So, Michael, thank you so much for joining me here. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Ja, ihr Lieben, das war's auch schon wieder. Das war der Dissens-Podcast für diese Woche. Ich hoffe mal, die Folge hat euch gefallen. Ich mache ja nicht alle Tage Folgen auf Englisch, aber die Chance, die konnte ich mir nun wirklich nicht entgehen lassen. Michael Hart, ja, eine Person, die zusammen mit Tony Negri sehr einflussreich in meiner Politisierung war, ja, ihn hier einzuladen in den Podcast. Ich bin sehr happy, dass das geklappt hat und dass er ja mich hier besucht hat. Ja, und unter allen Fördermitgliedern des Podcasts werde ich auch ein Exemplar seines aktuellen Buches The Subversive 70s, über das wir hier gesprochen haben, werde ich ein Exemplar verlosen. Wenn ihr also noch nicht dabei seid als Fördermitglieder beim Dissens-Podcast, dann macht doch jetzt mit. Ihr habt dann die Chance auf coole Gewinne und Goodies, aber natürlich tut ihr auch etwas Gutes, und zwar supportet ihr meine Arbeit und sorgt dafür, dass ich kostenlos, unabhängig und werbefrei für alle da draußen senden kann. Alles klar, Leute, das war's dann auch von mir soweit. Bleibt nur noch zu sagen, danke euch fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal.